mentioned to my colleagues, I've actually been in the building, but I was on a couple of necessary detours. We are called into session. We have several bills up today. The first bill is House Bill 2350, so I'll call us into work session and ask council to advise us where we are on that.
Mr. Chairman, the committee passed this to the floor with a due pass recommendation, I believe, last Friday, sort of quickly along with some other bills, and I forgot to inform the committee that the committee needed to simply rescind the prior referral to Ways and Means. Purely technical matter, so if someone would like to make that motion.
I entertain a motion. Representative Brzezinski?
I'll make that motion that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 2350.
All right. Under reconsideration, Representative Brzezinski moves that we rescind the referral of House Bill 2350 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can we just get on the record as to why we're doing that?
Council?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, the original bill did have a referral to Ways and Means. The dash two amendments were the only amendments adopted by the committee. Those replaced the original content of the bill. It was the determination of both Ann Christian and John Bradley, and I understand now of the fiscal office that it does not need to go to Ways and Means.
This is the bill that, I guess, Multnomah County, John Bradley came in on. Is it the STOP or the STEP program?
The STOP program, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. The referral to Ways and Means is rescinded. And that concludes the work session on House Bill 2350. We now move into public hearing, combined public hearing, on House Bill 2535 and Senate Bill 700. We had these matters up yesterday. President Hanson?
On 2350, if we...
On the previous one,
2350,
yes.
If we've rescinded the referral to Ways and Means, where have we left it?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the original motion was to send it to the floor, and that hasn't changed. It was simply a pure technicality. We had to make sure it didn't go to Ways and Means.
Okay, so. Right. And on 2535 and Senate Bill 700, we're having a combined public hearing. Do we have any sign-ups, Rachel? Thank you. Now, we had two gentlemen actually signed up from yesterday who have advised me that, three people actually, that they defer speaking today. So unless they tell me they wave at me. Mr. Harder, did you want to come up and testify? Please come forward. Rod Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, the National Rifle Association consultant for Oregon. I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bill 700. Senate Bill 700 is intrusive, abusive, and unenforceable. It is ill-conceived and poorly written. The simple little bill, as the proponents call it, affects transfers of firearms between individuals. It affects garage sales. It affects flea markets, whatever that means, the parking lot where people park to attend a gun show, and even the public streets outside. Should this bill not move forward, perhaps the 100 new state police officers approved by the House a couple of days ago can now go forward and do some constructive enforcement rather than police garage sales and flea markets. By the way, I was relieved to hear yesterday that our friends of NRA Bank, which are not flea markets, although some organizations who have fundraisers will still be classified as such under this bill. We've heard from Senator Burdick and Representative Leonard and others that all Senate Bill 700 does is do background checks at gun shows. We've heard the same rhetoric from them, from Representative Lundquist, from the media, seen it printed in editorials from one end of the state to the other. On Friday, their agenda finally became clear. Not only background checks, we must do checks and we must retain the records for 5 years. Gun registration is their agenda, and if they were to be honest, they would admit it. They truly want background checks at gun shows. It's a very easy issue. The National Rifle Association policy, as quoted by our president, Charlton Heston, is we support background checks at gun shows. We do not support the gathering of statistics or keeping records on law-abiding citizens. And unfortunately, when the word was spread around, the last sentence was not included. National Rifle Association does now, always has, and probably always will, support keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and other prohibited persons. This time, I would like to state for the record that nothing, repeat, nothing in Senate Bill 700 would have prevented the tragedies at Springfield and Littleton, and I abhor the proponents of this bill continuing to use their emotions resulting from those tragedies to advance their gun control agenda. I do find Senator Bryan's testimony yesterday and the analogy of the inconvenience of going through a security check at an airport accurate and right on the mark. Could not make my point any clearer. You go through the check, your luggage is examined, and when you are cleared, you continue on with your journey. No records, no government database, no threat of intrusion into your private life. The same can be should and be true of background checks on firearms. Do the check, identify the prohibited persons, keep records on those prohibited persons forever if necessary. But let the individual who's been cleared carry on with life without the government holding his or her name in yet another database of law-abiding citizens. Yesterday in the United States Senate, attempts by gun control advocates to place additional restrictions on gun shows was defeated. Should that send a message to us? I think it should. On Tuesday morning, I spoke with Senator Gordon Smith about this issue. He called me and advised me what was going to be happening in Congress this week. There will be an amendment to the juvenile crime bill that will direct FBI, BATF, and any other government agency not to keep records on honest citizens, period, end of report. No records, and this hopefully will take care of the illegal record-keeping situation that's taking place now. This should be the law of the land. 700 is terrible public policy. I ask this committee to do justice to Senate Bill 700, give it a quick demise and immediate burial it deserves. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on that bill.
Representative Yanella?
Yes, Mr. Harder, we heard testimony yesterday about gun confiscation in Australia. Do you have any information on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gianella, yes, I do. There was a very terrible tragedy in Australia several years back. Based on that, they disarmed the entire country, or at least attempted to disarm the entire country in about 2 months. There was a question by Representative Bowman yesterday, did the citizens give up their guns willingly? No, they did not. And from the Melbourne Herald Sun, killings rise in gun hunts. Up to 1 million illegal and unregistered firearms could still be hidden in Victoria homes despite the gun buyback scheme and new amnesty. They are not giving up their guns voluntarily. Crime rates, as was brought out by Representative Sinceri yesterday, crimes against people, that's attacks against people, rape, murder, burglary, robbery, have gone up 31%. I do not have that documentation in front of me. It is somewhere in my files, but it is a result of a newspaper article in Melbourne. The number of firearms and crime used in crimes has not changed. They have gone up. This is another quote from the Melbourne paper. And I would like to just take the time to read one paragraph from another news report from South Australia. It says, police in South Australia's mid-north say they've seized 15 firearms from homes in the towns of Tarawai. I'm not sure I pronounced that right. Officers from Hallett, Jamestown, Spalding, and Port Pierre visited 20 homes in the town, checking firearms licenses and security measures. 7 residents were reported for various alleged offenses, including having an unregistered firearm, not having a license, and insufficient security for a firearm. Police say the weapons range from air rifles to shotguns. Police spokesman says those reported are expected to be summoned to appear in court at a later date.
President Obama.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harder, first I want to say that I disagree with your characterization of people who are looking for gun safety legislation as being anti-gun advocates. I think that's an inappropriate label to be putting on people who are looking for ways to keep their families safe. So that's number one. Number two, you talked about the rhetoric of anti-gun advocates talking about wanting to... The issue about the records is a separate issue. I thought I heard you say that you support people having background checks at gun shows. Did you say that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I think there was only one question that you asked, and that was the latter one. NRA's policy is to support background checks at gun shows as long as there is no record keeping, and that is not a change.
If I may follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Mr. Harder, I think most of the general public is getting tired of the NRA rhetoric around law-abiding citizens and our attempt to somehow diminish the Second Amendment. The public wants to assure that only law-abiding citizens have guns. What would you suggest that the public does to ensure that guns are only in the hands of people who are responsible gun owners?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, my suggestion is if you want to do background checks, and the problem that's been identified in this bill is background checks at gun shows. My answer to your problem with background checks at gun shows is to do it, but don't keep records on honest citizens. I can't give you an answer about how to make sure only people that are law-abiding citizens have guns. Perhaps arrest every person that stands on a corner at Saturday night and see if they have a gun in their pocket and see if it's legal for them to have it. I don't want to go there, and I'm sure you don't either.
Thank you. Representative Hansen?
Well, I think this committee has had a record of kind of throwing out wacky ideas. So I'll throw one on the table now and maybe get your response to it. If we required background checks for every gun transfer, kept no records, but in order to make sure that the law was enforced, made not checking the record and transferring a firearm a Class C felony, would that meet your support?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, give me the last part of that again?
To create the common principle that a background check would be done on every firearm transfer, okay, as one premise. Not keep records on it, but if there was an investigation that could prove that a background check wasn't done, selling and transferring ownership of a firearm without doing the background check would be a Class C felony.
Representative Manick, Representative Hansen, no, I wouldn't support that because we're talking about a father giving the son a gun. That's a transfer. We're talking about transfers between friends or individuals. We're talking about private sales between individuals. No, that's an intrusion, and I would not support something like that.
I'm sure we could clarify it in terms of inter-family transfers and inheritance transfers and those type things, but stranger to stranger transfers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think if you would read the provisions of 2435 or whatever the number of this next bill is, that you would find that comes very close to doing that.
I think
it does not have a Class C felony, and I would not sure I'd want to go there. But I'm glad you brought the Class C felony up because I would very much like to see a Class C felony for inappropriate use of these records that are being retained.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sincera.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a form of comment. I wouldn't support no records because I want records on felons kept. We need to have that information. Felons who attempt to buy guns, we need to have that information, that data. And I just don't want records kept on people who have not broken any laws, who are not a felon, and that's where I want to see it.
Thank you, Representative Sinceri. Any other questions or comments for Mr. Harder? Thank you, Mr. Harder. We appreciate your coming.
You're welcome. Would you like me to comment on 2535? Probably not.
Well, it's up to you, Mr. Harder.
With regards to 2535, we have not seen the final draft of that particular missive. There were some changes, technical changes made, I understand, yesterday evening, and from what I know about the bill, it has a very limited number of positive advantages for gun owners. It does have It opens the system to everyone, Representative Hansen, that could do a background check voluntarily, and that person would then be relieved from liability. And that, to me, is a carrot rather than a stick. it creates, I think, the opportunity for citizens who want relief from liability to go ahead with the background check and pay for it, and then not have to worry about being sued. Aside from those things, I would have to see the remainder of the bill before I'm going to take a position.
I would indicate that there's some additional revised versions of 2535 that have been ordered up on a priority basis from Legislative Council. I hope to have them ready by noon today so we can take a look at that and see what it has to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sean Clemens and Chris Clemens, you can come up together if you'd like. Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee, we are here to address an aspect of 2535, which deals with child access prevention. And for the record, I am Chris Clemens, live here in Salem, and this is my wife, Sharon. First of all, we'd like to share our personal experience, why we are here, and I'd like to allow my wife to speak.
Hi. My nephew, Joshua Kilgore, was I'm trying not to cry.
Would you like some water?
Sure. He was accidentally shot and killed by his best friend, October 8th, 1998. The house where the accident occurred, they're a very nice family. They're law-abiding citizens. You know, do we want to see charges pressed or, you know, something bad happened to them? No, but I truly believe had there been a law, you know, already, thank you. You know, like I said, they're law-abiding citizens, this family, it would have been a deterrent. I believe that my nephew would probably be here today if there had been a law stating that you cannot leave loaded firearms in the home when there is no adult supervision. There was no adult home. Statistics show this happens time and time again when, you know, teenagers are left home alone, no adults in the home. You know, it never happens when the parents are home because there's no law saying that there should be. You know, nothing happens. I mean, you can go into a grocery store and steal an item and be prosecuted and possibly do time for that, but yet someone can die in your home and nothing happens? There's no, I don't know. It's unfathomable to me to think that my nephew is gone and there's no law saying that that was wrong. To leave a loaded firearm out in a teenager's bedroom, and I don't know. I'm sorry.
Well, House Bill 2535, in its present amended state, or as proposed to be amended, has two provisions in it. One says that if any person leaves their firearm with a trigger lock in place or in a locked container, so that they've restricted access to it, that person is exempt from liability should anyone gain access to that firearm. That's an incentive to use safe practices and use trigger locks or locked containers to eliminate or reduce access. Another provision in that set of amendments says that if a child under the age of 15 is allowed access to a loaded firearm, which is not set with a trigger lock and is not in a lock container, and there is no supervision, and that child uses the firearm and injures or kills someone within the next 24 hours, that the owner of that firearm is held liable for a violation. Meaning then that we could publicize that it is unlawful for any person to leave a loaded firearm without being secured with a trigger guard or a trigger lock or put in a lockbox, accessible to persons under the age of 15 without adult supervision. designed to change the mindset to say not only is it unsafe, which any firearms person would tell you, but it's also illegal. It would not criminalize the conduct. It would make it a violation subject to a fine. That would certainly, if we get the right word out to the community about that, we'd get the message out that this is an inappropriate practice. It's already considered unsafe by people who know about handling firearms, but it's also now going to be considered illegal by the government. That won't bring the nephew back. It might help prevent other tragedies like that from happening in the future. I appreciate your willingness, Mrs. Clemens, to share that difficult story with us. And Mr. Clemens, did you want to comment further?
Yes, I would. And that's why we're here, is to prevent this from happening, Mr. Chairman. I do have a copy of your latest amendments, which have a today or yesterday's date on them. There are some concerns that I have in some of this language. I don't understand why there is a 24-hour acquiring limit on this version. It doesn't make sense to me that if a child gains access to a firearm the morning before and then takes that firearm to school the next day, that there would be no penalty under this current provision. Also, to me, it doesn't make sense that there are only penalties, a violation, whatever that means, if someone is killed or injured. It's like saying if you don't wear your seatbelt, it's not a crime unless you get in a crash. It seems to me that it would be more appropriate to have language that it is unlawful to store a firearm if someone is killed or injured, or if that child commits any crime with that weapon, such as taking it to school. You should hold the parents responsible if that child takes that gun to school, which in Oregon last year we had 57 handguns, 10 rifles taken to our public schools. If that child takes that firearm, whether it's loaded or not, and threatens another person, there should be penalties against the gun owner for that child gaining access to that gun. These are some things that I ask you to discuss in work session. I appreciate you taking a look at this issue and trying to include it. I would ask that if it is possible, this portion of 2535 be taken up on its own merits, similarly to what Representative had in 2677 with amendments to include an agreeable fashion. I think this is too important of an issue to get caught up in the large issue that you are all dealing with, Senate Bill 700 and background checks at gun shows. This issue needs to stand on its own, and lives will be saved by passing a law, whether it's a weak law, which is simply a violation. If, in fact, you do that, I would ask that you have a civil penalty of at least $1,000 if you're not going to include any criminal penalties. The statistics are very clear that states that have these laws have less accidental shootings. They have also less children killed. It's estimated from the American Medical Association that states that had these laws saved 39 deaths of young children in the same five-year period that these statistics were analyzed. If all states had the law, 216 children might have lived because of safe access laws that were not in those states. There is an overwhelming amount of evidence that firearms in homes are a very large contributor to children killing themselves. It is the most common form of suicide. We have been brought into this by the death of our nephew. I was totally unaware of how large of a problem this is in the United States and here in Oregon. I would add that a boy that I mentored was also accidentally shot and killed in his best friend's home November 2nd of last year. And so this this issue has made us do some homework on this, and please consider what we've had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clemens. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Clemens, for being here today. Ms. Clemens, how old was your nephew?
14.
And Mr. Clemens, how old was that young man that you were mentoring?
He was 18.
And so, Mr. Clemens, if you look at House Bill 2535 that limits the illegal access to someone 15 or younger, in that situation, this bill would have no impact.
That's correct. On the boy that I mentored, that's correct.
You also mentioned the violation as being, let me explain a violation. A violation is like a parking ticket. That kids get it when they're caught smoking tobacco and they're underage. You know, we get tickets if you're driving too fast. That's what a violation is, and I concur with you that that's a very weak way to address this issue. And hopefully this committee will consider your recommendation about the 1,000. I'd like to see it significantly higher than that, but the reality of where we are how things are moving, I think that's probably unlikely this session, unfortunately. But I really appreciate both of you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the clinics, I just want to let you know there is a representative here, Vicki Walker, who's been doing a lot of work on suicide prevention, and she's done a lot of the background work that you brought forward as to the accessibility of guns. You may want to make contact with her. I know she has a couple of pieces of legislation that are pending, and her office is on the fourth floor of the House wing. It's Vicki Walker. And thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Norman Cobb. Rachel, Mr. Cobb has some written testimony to submit. Good morning, Mr. Cobb. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Norman Cobb. I live in Kaiser, and I'm privileged to serve on the board of the Oregon State Shooting Association. I attended the initial hearing on Senate Bill 700 before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Like many others, I was dazzled by the splendor of the uniformed senior police officials present, all of whom apparently supported passage of SB 700. Indeed, the only group of law enforcement people distinguished by their absence were representatives of the various police collective bargaining organizations from around our state, not one single representative of a patrolman's union made an appearance. Similarly, neither yesterday nor today that I have seen has a police union official testified in behalf of his brethren. One would think that were the gun shows, the uncontrolled arms bazaars supplying the criminal underworld with illegal guns that the proponents of SB 700 would lead us to believe, the police unions would be here en masse demanding that this bill be passed to protect the life and limb of their members. For that matter, would not rank and file police personnel themselves make whatever effort might be necessary to come before this committee to plead for passage of SB 700 on behalf of themselves and their families? Would not their spouses demand that SB 700 become law? No, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, individual street cops are not here because passage of SB 700 is a political rather than a law enforcement issue. It is a political solution desperately in search of a problem. Stated plainly, it is a legislative effort to prove to the public that something is being done about crime. I urge this committee to give SB 700 the merciful death that it deserves so that the legislature can get on with matters which are truly worthy of its time and efforts. I respond to any questions. And
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Carr.
Good morning.
Mr. Cobb, did you hear testimony yesterday that law enforcement are at every gun show, and at every gun show in the state of Oregon, they arrest people who have purchased guns who are not eligible to be law-abiding gun owners?
Representative Bowman, Chairman Mannix, no, I did not hear that.
Okay.
In fact, I don't think that that is a truly accurate quote of what was said.
Okay.
Question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Cobb, where do you think gang members get guns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, never having been a gang member,
neither have I.
Not acquainted with one. All I can do is offer an opinion.
That's what I'm asking for.
Opposed fact. My opinion is that many of them they obtain from their peers, which in turn originally are generated through thefts, primarily burglaries. Indeed, it wasn't all that many years ago when it was evident that a good many stolen firearms were being smuggled south, eventually to Mexico, the smugglers returning with narcotics to Oregon.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Cobbs, what in your opinion should lawmakers be doing to make sure that children do not have access to firearms?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, I'm here to testify on 700 with respect to the seconds checks at gun shows.
Mr. Cobb, you have the right not to answer my question.
Dealing with my opinion about children.
Are you saying... go ahead, Mr. Cobb.
Thank you, sir. My feeling is that, reflecting upon my own younger years, which were a good many years ago, that what problem exists with respect to children and firearms commences in the home. When I was a youngster, the age of the younger person that was mentioned by the immediate past witnesses, we had lots of guns. I never thought of abusing the firearm. For one thing, I was completely aware, as was my sister, that had we done that along with any other manner of transgression, my dad would have whaled the tar out of us. With respect to the 18-year-old that was mentioned, at the time I was 18, I was in the Marine Corps. Again, if you got an 18-year-old that is abusing an arm, I think probably he was simply not brought up in the right way with respect to that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cobb, you're appearing here today as an individual.
Yes, sir.
And I also take it that you don't have any authority or have not heard from any of the line or field officers as to having objections to SB 700?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb. Vice President Simmons.
I would just like to comment. Several of my colleagues here in the House have indicated they have had calls from field officers saying that 700 is a bad idea, expressing their objections to their elected representatives that that 700 is unneeded, and just like you to note that.
I was going to ask Mr. Chairman, Representative Simmons, if I may, why are not one or the other of them present if it's that important?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. It does raise a curious question.
Perhaps, Mr. Cobb, they have full confidence in our capability to discern whatever the right thing is to do.
I'm sure they must. Mr. Chairman, if it's of any help to the committee, the issue of what's occurring overseas with respect to private ownership of firearms has been raised. For about a year now, I've been following that as closely as I can, primarily on the Internet. If the committee were to have any questions, I'd do my best to answer them with regard to that issue.
Apparently not. Thank you very much for coming this morning.
Thank
you. Appreciate
your
testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2535 or Senate Bill 700? Speak now or forever hold your peace. The public hearing combined on HB 2535 and now the public hearing on HB 2535 and SB 700 is recessed. There may be a work session on one or both of these bills later today. We will be recessed as to those bills until further notice. I would mention to my colleagues that I'm going to see whether or not we can come back at 12:30 for a possible work session, coming back from recess as to those two bills. I have checked, and the Judiciary Civil Committee comes in here at 1. We have a floor session at 10:15, but I believe we also have an evening session at 4, so that we might have to cut our own lunch times a little short to come back in here. That would be to see if there are amendments proposed to come to the committee with some sort of package presentation. The other bills that we have, we will continue to hear, and Representative Bowman asked that we try to adjourn by 10 o'clock, as she has a 10 o'clock commitment, and there's a 10:15 session anyway, so we'll try to move a pace on those. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's maybe some conflict of one still being on the floor late to the it seems like that's how we've been working our morning session. I also believe both of the respective parties will need caucusing today's Thursday.
That's a good point.
That's great information.
Well, maybe we'll get Civil's permission to come in the midst of their session for half an hour. There's a timing reason for some of these things. All right, but we are recessed as to those two bills, not adjourned. And we will move on to Senate Bill 34A, convene the public hearing on Senate Bill 34A. I'll call up Dale Penn on 34A and then after that, James Rice. Mr. Penn? Oh, there he is. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney, representing the District Attorneys Association on this bill. This bill changes a rule of law concerning the release of a victim's or a witness's address or phone number, the release of that address and phone number personally to a defendant in a criminal case. Right now, the process is that any victim or witness may request that the court order that this information, the address and phone number, not be released to a defendant. And so as a practice, most district attorney's offices have forms and will have a victim come in or a witness come in, sign this motion, we will submit it to a judge, and I have never heard of one of these requests ever being denied. However, it's a process that requires the victim to come down to the courthouse, it requires paperwork, it requires timing to have that submitted to a judge, and then this order entered. Because this process has never been a situation where the courts have ever refused to do this, we felt that we should change the rule of law so that the standard practice would be this information should not be provided to the defendant unless the court orders that it should be. So this would prevent the necessity of having you have this paperwork filed in every case, requiring victims and witnesses to come to the courthouse to sign the forms. And then there are cases where victims and witnesses are unable to get to the courthouse to sign the motion and order. And so this is a procedure that simply say, we're going to generally say this information should not be given to the defendant himself. It's still provided to the attorney, so that the attorney can do their investigation, but it's not provided to the defendant. If for some reason there's a need to provide the address and phone number of the victim or the witness to the defendant, then we would have a process, and if the court orders it, then it would be done. So that's the process. That's what the bill does. We believe it makes the system work more smoothly, and it simply recognizes just the way the system operates now without having to go through some bureaucracy and paperwork to accomplish it.
Representative Kozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dell, I thought we took care of this last session, that we did around where it wasn't had to be the request. Apparently, didn't take it through.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, I don't recall that. I just don't recall that. No.
Any further questions? That seems sincere.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. If you'll please stand by, we'll call up Mr. Rice to hear from the opposition.
Good morning, Chairman Mannix, members of the committee. I'm not sure opposition's the right term here. I think Mr. Penn...
Something against box size.
Well, you have to check something almost always. Sort of talking about the process of how this should be done, I think Mr. Penn kind of laid out what happens, and in many, many of my cases, it's indicated that the defendant shouldn't receive the address of the victim, and it's not a problem because I never have my client going out doing investigation anyway. I mean, we have investigators that do that. I probably only would potentially lead to more difficult problems. I guess I see the system working fine the way it is. The victims usually are down at the courthouse anyway, I would assume, testifying before the grand jury or making other appearances. The only problem I see is going to be when, for some reason, the address does need to be given. The process is going to involve more paperwork, more court time, more lawyer time. I guess I also believe that the process works really well. I've only had one case in recent years where there was an issue of the district attorney, for very good reasons, not wanting to divulge the address of the victim to anyone. The person let me know that. We worked around the problem. So I guess I see the system working fairly well the way it is and don't see a great reason for change when it's going to involve additional paperwork.
Mr. Rice, is it the defense side that has to process all the paperwork that Mr. Penn referred to, or is it the prosecution side that has to process all that paperwork?
Well, I guess I see the defense lawyer found the paperwork, and of course that takes time, and secretary's typing it, and then the DA needs to respond to it, and the judge has got to be there. Maybe we have to have a court reporter there, and there's a docketing person. It takes a number of people to actually make these things happen within the judicial system.
And under the current system?
Under the current system, we're notified. I mean, the DA just has a standard form that says, don't release it.
That's what I was getting at. It seems to me under the current system, there may be 100 units of workload for the DA, and under the revised system, there may be one unit of workload for the defense attorney on the occasion when you want that address and you need to request it.
Those numbers are probably within sort of reason. However, the one unit would involve stacks and lots of time, whereas we get a lot of paperwork and discovery, varying amounts, of course, depending on the case. But we get a packet of stuff, and a lot of it's just form work, and one of them is a form. So it's a very quick process to get that accomplished.
Under this, couldn't the DA simply agree to the authorization from the court? It doesn't say order. It says authorize.
I suppose they could do that, too. And actually, many of these things would probably be worked out without the court even becoming involved, because we negotiate as best we can to resolve all issues without judicial involvement.
Questions for Mr. Rice? Thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Penn, are you on the edge of your seat because you wanted a little rebuttal? Come on up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dale Penn. I just wanted to make it clear that, in fact, I have never heard statewide any time when it has been necessary for the defense to get an order to release the victim or witness's telephone number or address personally to the defendant. I've just never seen that happen. So we have thousands and thousands of these orders going through the system now when it's unnecessary. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before...
Oh, Representative Pozanski,
no,
we
no,
have
no, a... No, he's fine.
All right.
I know we're going to move this. I just want to make sure we don't have a conflicting answer, because I'm looking at where this is at, 135.815, but it is on the discovery part. And then there's some stuff about when an address and phone number of the victim or witness shall not be under 135.970. So we can just have a moment.
Sure. Mr. Penn, I cut you off because I wanted you to quit while you were ahead. Did you want to add something?
I think that the provision, Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, I think the provision he's looking at, and one that Mr. Rice mentioned, this is not a process where the district attorney is requesting to refuse to give the address to anyone. There is a procedure for protective order where you would say, you would have a hearing. This becomes a full-blown hearing. I've done it a few times in death penalty cases and others where witnesses and victims are very frightened of the defense, and they will be willing to submit to interviews, but they don't want anyone to know their address and phone number. That is a totally separate process. It is rarely utilized. This is a procedure where the information is given to the attorney, but it's just said to be prohibited to give it personally to the defendant, the one that this bill deals with.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just give this to Dell, let him look at it, just make sure that we're putting the right place in the statute.
Still on 34. President Pozanski is asking whether or not the reference to 135.970.
Yes, unless the court's giving the victim's information to the defense attorney? Yeah. They could give it to the defendant unless there is a do not disclose order. Even if there is a do not disclose order, it has to be given to the defense attorney in the first way.
Mr. Chair, I just might say for the record, I believe that the concern of Representative Przanski is there is a separate statute that talks about this process where a victim or witness may come forward and make a request to have this information concealed. The amendment that we have in this bill addresses the statute, and so it had set up the presumption or the general rule that it would not be provided. However, in the bill, it does allow for a hearing, and so the Senate chose not to amend out this procedure where the victim and witness still could come forward on their own motion and ask to have this court order. So I don't think that they duplicate each other. The second one where the victim or witness would need to make the request is probably never going to be utilized if we change the rule, or rarely utilized. But I think that was the concern of Representative Przanski. Perhaps we should at least acknowledge that it is still there. But it is an ability that the victim or the witness has to provide their own motion, as opposed to what our bill does is sets the general rule that it will be done in this manner.
Mr. Chair, that's pretty correct as to my reading of 135.970 is what we actually use now
as to making that request from the court. The bill that we have before us does not make any reference, at least I didn't see any reference to that section, and I'm wondering if we, before we...
It does, actually.
I see that. I see it now, section six.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also in section three and five.
Okay. I feel fine.
Okay.
Make sure we'll cross-check.
We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 34.
Mr. Chair.
President Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 34 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 34 sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer Representative Brzezanski will be the carrier. This closes the work session on Senate Bill 34. We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 35. We have a representative of the Department of Education here to explain why we have got this bill back in front of us. Good morning.
Good morning again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For your record, Greg McMurdo from the Department of Education. I do want to thank you for bringing this bill back. What I think the committee was not aware of when they sent the bill to the floor with the House amendments is that your amendments affect also classified employees that the Department of Education has the responsibility for determining their eligibility or suitability to work in public schools. And what you've done with your amendments is treat licensed employees, teachers, differently than non-teaching employees that work in school districts. I'm not certain that you wanted to do that. The reason for that is a statute in the Education Code, 326.603, which by reference tells the State Board of Education and the Department it is to look at the crimes that are listed in 342.143, which is the amendment that you made. What this would do is that if an individual who is a classified employee has been convicted of any of the crimes that are now enumerated in 342.143, they would be permanently barred from employment by an Oregon school district, whereas a teacher's would be barred from employment only for the time frames you specified for felonies and misdemeanors. So you would have the probability of two employees that would be treated differently for conviction of the same crime. Additionally, something else now that this bill is back in committee that legislative counsel has brought to our attention and I believe to other state agencies is that with the apparent passage of Senate Bill 1315, which will change the normal effective date of bills, we would request that you put an emergency clause on this bill. Otherwise, it would not be effective until January, and we were hoping it would be effective in the early fall, which is when most of the employees that we have to screen, most of those applications come through at that time. We do have some representatives from the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, I believe, in fact, the chairman of the commission, that would like to talk to you about the substance of your amendments, Mr. Chair. And I would, for those of you that are not aware, TSPC is not part of the Department of Education and is a separate state agency, but they are also affected by this bill.
Well, in fact, this bill was requested by the Department of Education.
That's correct.
And it was filed by the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. It went through the Senate. Now it's gone through us. And on its way to the floor, I was asked to have it sent back. Before I call up the folks from TSPC, are they in agreement or disagreement with your concerns?
Mr. Chair, their concerns, I think, are different from our concerns. What I believe TSPC would like to have you do is recede from your amendments. They believe that some of the crimes that now you have made it more lenient for the employment of those of certain teachers, that they would like to see that the bar for employment for teachers be a permanent bar. They can speak to that, I'm sure, better than I can.
All right. Thank you. I'll invite up Charlie Sharps and Bob Gerke from TSPC. And perhaps somebody could explain to me, did we somehow amend this bill without telling anybody, or maybe people didn't notice, or maybe we didn't notice? Good morning.
Morning. Mr. Chair and Representatives, my name is Bob Gerke, and I'm an elementary principal in Jacksonville, Oregon, and I'm current chair of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Mr. Chair, I'm Charlie Sharp, Superintendent Principal of Elkton Schools.
And a Commissioner of Teacher Standards and Practices.
And by the way, we will call this a public hearing as well as work session, a possible work session. I noticed it was posted as such, so when I call this into work session, we're really, for the record, in public hearing. Please go ahead.
We are having the young lady pass out a letter written by David Mighton, who's our executive director, and the commission is meeting today and tomorrow, and David is over at a committee meeting right now, so ask that we sit in for him. The letter is fairly self-explanatory as far as our concerns. I don't know the answer to your question, but it was my understanding that it did get amended without our knowing about it. But
of course, we do publish notice of all work sessions. Maybe somebody wasn't here.
That's very possible.
And the reason I mention that is it's not like we're working on 3 hours notice. We do 36 hours notice on all bills, and normally if someone's involved in a bill, they will come to the work session, and we put all the amendments out on the table, and people will say, well, wait a minute, I see a problem here, and then we'll say, well, then let's hold it over. But our practice is if no one's complained and it's out there and it looks okay, we'll often say, well, let's do it. So I'm just mentioning that. It wasn't like we were trying to ram this down anybody's throats. So we just didn't know about the problem.
So I thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Not being part of the circle up here, I'm not exactly sure what did or didn't happen.
Sometimes we wonder how the process works, too. Please go ahead.
We are concerned. If you look at the back of the letter that was handed out to you, you'll notice the names of several people who have had their licenses permanently revoked under current statute.
And your point being from your testimony that you would have to go back and at least they'd have the opportunity for reinstatement, they can apply for reinstatement, and if given that opportunity to be reinstated and you refused it, they can go through a contested case hearing, and you're creating this. And the question is from a policy perspective, why should people with these kinds of convictions, largely involving sex offenses, be eligible to be back into the circle of folks who can work with kids in schools?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and thank you for saving me from having to say that.
Let me ask this. Is it possible for the three of you gentlemen to work with legislative counsel on an amendment to this bill that would satisfy all of your concerns, and then you could just come in and tell us what it does? And, of course, we'd want to hear if anybody objected to it, but if everyone agreed, we'd probably be pretty amenable to effectuating that.
You bet. I'd be happy to take the lead on that, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is the committee comfortable with that approach? All right, that's what we'll do. And I would ask you to expedite that process, and we would reset this for a work session after we receive some proposed amendment. Representative Bowman, may have a comment?
No, not for the gentleman there, but for legislative counsel. Is sex abuse 3 a misdemeanor, or is that a felony crime?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, it is a Class A misdemeanor.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, if you would do that, we'd like to try to move this out again next week. We don't want to slow down this process, but we also don't want to move so fast that we don't take care of these things. I appreciate your bringing this problem to our attention before we send something along too far.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Any additional comments, or are you okay with that?
No.
Representative Hansen,
if I can.
Question.
Clearly, you look at that list of the people and the crimes that they've taken, and I have no doubt that Standards and Practices Commission would not reinstate them after 5 years. I'd also be real doubtful that these people would ever reapply for reinstatement, just from the standpoint that kind of the nature of the people that commit these types of crimes aren't the types that want to publicize it through a contested case to fight to on the front page of the Oregonian, fighting to get their license back after a 5 year period. So I wouldn't be real convinced that this is going to be a real problem for you, that all of these people, I think it'd be very doubtful that one of them would ever reapply. And if they did, I would imagine you'd take care of it. By the time you turn down the first two, you probably wouldn't be much of a problem.
I think their problem, Representative Hansen, is ways and means, fiscal impact kind of problem. You'd be surprised how much one contested case will cost them, and it hits them big on their appropriations. These commissions don't have big bucks, and one contested case can throw their appropriation off, and they end up in front of the E-Board trying to explain to some irate legislators how they managed to spend so much money.
just a reality check.
May I respond?
Respond and then Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, first I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your understanding of a big part of our problem. And we have a backlog now that we're struggling through with the normal discipline cases that we deal with. I might point out that Mr. Craig Motaz, 1999, towards the bottom there, was convicted of that in California, immediately pursued and brought himself to Oregon and applied for license and was denied, and we went through a whole hearing process, and he even showed up at the commission meeting to appeal our decision as a commission. He is representative of many of these kinds of people who don't give up. They do come back, and they come back, and they come back, and they come back. And I'm sure you can as easily as I figure out what their interests are, but they do come back, unfortunately, and expect somehow to slip through the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to suggest some real minor language change that said, with the exception of anyone convicted of sex crime, and for that exception, that would be a lifetime ban. I mean, because obviously, if you look at this list, I don't think any of us would want any of these people anywhere near a classroom ever.
Ever.
So I think it's a real minor change that we're talking about. So I just want to offer that as a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that, and Representative Bowman, I think there are some other crimes other than the sex offenses that rise to that nature, and those would be crimes involving endangering the welfare of a minor or drug-related crimes. So I don't think you can just limit those crimes to the sex offenses.
Well, if you all would come back with your professional expertise, Representative Bowman, I'm sorry.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say, I think we're going to disagree with that, because I do believe that someone who has been previously convicted of drugs can, in fact, be a good citizen and a good teacher and a good example for young people about why they should not be involved. So,
bring us back your best professional judgment on it, and then we can evaluate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This concludes the public hearing on Senate Bill 35. And we'll move on to Senate Bill 78, convening the public hearing. Counsel, would you summarize the measure?
Oh, certainly, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill, Senate Bill 78A, has to do with situations in which a juvenile has that case referred to criminal or municipal court. In current law, authorizes that certain cases be waived up, and really for the purposes of this bill, we're not talking about, for example, ballot measure 11 offenses. Rather, we are talking about certain property crimes, motor vehicle, boating, and game law offenses. What this bill does is allows a juvenile court to recall a case sent to criminal or municipal court if the juvenile fails to appear in criminal or municipal court. I believe in my summary I put juvenile court, and that should read municipal court.
I'll call up Steve Carmichael, Nancy Miller, and Kathy Osborne, all three of you, please. While they're coming up, is there anybody here who wants to speak for or against this bill? Speak now or forever hold your peace. I see no hands. So we're about to have a marriage ceremony. I've got three people who checked the four box.
Nancy wouldn't let anybody sign in who was against it.
Now, who goes first?
I do, Mr. Chair. Right. Thank you. For the record, Nancy Miller for the State Court Administrator's Office. This is a bill proposed by the Judicial Department, and I'm passing you out testimony that was given by Judge Terry Legert from Marion County over on the Senate side. I apologize that we didn't get to change the testimony for your committee and that the judge could not be here today. She is on the bench.
That's okay. We probably would have only given her 2 minutes anyway, since we're looking at a 10 o'clock.
Good bill should pass, Mr. Chair. I think that committee counsel did a really good job. This closes up a loophole in the system that does not allow the court to detain kids who fail to appear or who violate their probation. The biggest issue is in drunk drive cases. Because of that loophole, these kids cannot be held. There's a mandatory 48-hour hold. They can't be held. If they violate probation, they can't be held. This bill allows that to happen, and that's the very short version.
President Bowman?
Mr. Chair, are these young people in custody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, most often not.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, it says that we would take the youth to an assessment center.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, those are the amendments that we didn't know about until this morning, and Mr. Carmichael's here to speak to those.
Oh.
That's where your marriage ceremony could possibly
fall apart.
An
early divorce. Let me hear first from Kathy Osborne. You were okay with the bill as it came over from the Senate?
Yes, for the record, Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. We are in favor of 78A as it came over from the Senate. It does close a loophole that has been a problem, and this committee may remember that they've actually added some offenses that could be mandatorily waived to municipal court, and with those additions, this could become even more of a problem in that there's no way to create a sanction for a child who doesn't appear or who fails to do what the judge has ordered the youth to do.
All right. Now, Mr. Carmichael, what's your pitch on these A3 amendments which we've just received? I will mention, by the way, when there are no amendments being offered to a bill that's come over from Senate, it's been through Senate Judiciary, that's a pretty good filtering process. We have a great deal of confidence, and then we're usually just then looking for policy issues, yay or nay, which is why I sometimes kiddingly talk about moving along, but we expect them or hope that they'll do the same with the bills that we've tried to craft pretty carefully, and that's why we talk about this, but we're certainly always looking at the policy implications. Mr. Carmichael.
Yes, I'm Steve Carmichael. I'm the president of the Juvenile Department Directors Association for the state. I think the caboose analogy is the correct one. We don't have any disagreement with Senate Bill 78 the way it came from the Senate, but we have some added provisions that we think are important to pass out of this legislative session. The amendments relate to a problem that came very vividly to the state almost a year ago when the Springfield shooting occurred in our county. And after that shooting, we all, the legislature and our agency...
Mr. Carmichael, please get to the point. I'm sorry.
Okay.
We understand
okay.
The background.
Okay. We looked at what we could have done differently. And one of the things that we found is that police officers at that point, the Springfield police, had the choice if there was an immediate danger to bring the child to detention. They had confiscated the gun. The parents could take custody, so there was not immediate danger. And they needed to release that child without an assessment being done.
Isn't there a bill that's already been processed or in process, I'll call it, relates to the Kip Kinkle type scenario? The assessment, the question of custody, what to do with firearms.
And Senate Bill 344.
Yes.
And that's in front of the Education Committee.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be the more appropriate vehicle to raise this issue?
Perhaps. That bill applies only to guns in schools, where our amendments are a suggestion that any juvenile who has violated the law and is taken into custody, who a law enforcement officer feels needs an assessment, the law enforcement officer does not have to make that decision on the street, but can, in fact, have that done by professionals.
Rep. Sinceri, what's the relating clause, if you happen to know, on that guns in schools?
It's actually quite narrow. It relates to firearms in the schools.
Right, so there's the problem there. Okay. So we're back to the broader issue, and you have a broader relating clause here.
Correct.
Go ahead.
So
I understand why you're not there.
Okay. Thank you. I'm not sure I did, but I understand now, so thank you.
Because that train doesn't have a linkage for a caboose.
Right, I understand that. Thank you very much. essentially, that's the argument, that law enforcement officers currently have to make the decision on the street whether to take a child to detention or release them, and it's based on immediate danger. And we've been flooded throughout the state, our department and others, in the last few weeks since the Colorado shooting, with all kinds of threats, all sorts of situations where there's not an immediate danger, but you sure do want that child to go through an assessment if there's been a law violation. So it simply moves the assessment process from a law officer on the street to allow them to take them to some place that's not detention, but is a place where that assessment can occur before they're released.
Sure. That's our concern.
A couple hundred bucks a pop. Who's paying for it?
This is a permissive recommendation, so it's not a requirement, it's not an unfunded mandate or any kind of a mandate. If Senate Bill 55 passes or some other vehicle for the Juvenile Crime Prevention Plan, I know in Lane County we will use some of that money from this legislative session to do assessments, and to do an assessment center. I think other communities may find other funds, and it's not a requirement. If a community doesn't have funds, they don't have to do it. But if a community does decide that's an appropriate process, this allows the law enforcement officer to bring the juvenile to that place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. One, are there any assessment centers in the 36 counties currently that are able to provide this service?
The only one I know of currently is in Clackamas County.
Mm-hmm.
We are building a shelter that we have taken part of the shelter and changed the configuration some, so it will be an assessment center that we'll have built in August. That's all I know of in Oregon. In other states, there are assessment centers in quite a few other states.
I know Multnomah County wants one, but whether we'll get it is another story. Second question is, this language appears on page 1, line 14 and 15, appears to require whoever initially comes in contact with that youth to have some kind of mental health assessment type skill. And so I guess my question is whether or not we are setting law enforcement, school employees, and other people up for civil liability because they don't, by osmosis, have that kind of training.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, I'm not sure if I see the line that you're referring to. The bold, the bold print is the only new.
And so, it's bold.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I got you. On line 14 and 15?
Do you need to make sure you're giving the right kind of assessment? That you, are you opening up someone to liability if they aren't properly qualified and they don't do a proper assessment? That's the kind of question that Mr. Bowman's asking about. Something happens because of their assessment.
I suppose that is a possibility that any assessment center would have to evaluate, is what kind of liability is there. Currently, I know our staff are concerned about that.
I'm sorry, sir, you're missing the question. The question had more to do with the person who initially comes into contact with that youth. So whether it's the school teacher, whether it's a police officer on the street, this appears to set up some kind of liability that says that teacher did not know that this kid was a mental health risk. So, therefore, they didn't go through the process to get them to the assessment center.
I understand what you're saying. I guess someone could make that argument. I think the person taking youth into custody would be not a teacher, and our attorneys here would have to decide that, but I think a law enforcement officer would be the person that would make that decision.
Mr. Carmichael, had you talked to Nancy Miller or Kathy Osborne about these amendments before?
I have not. This came through Representative Morissette's office, who I've been talking with for some weeks. They informed me yesterday that this was a bill that they felt would work, and they had gone to legislative council. So this happened within 24 hours.
In a friendly fashion, I'll mention that sometimes a light little caboose that's agreeable to the people who designed the train and built the tracks is okay. But it's clear to me that there are going to be a lot of issues and questions raised by this amendment to this particular bill. And I'd suggest that we scan the other remaining Senate bills over here, or even House bills on the Senate side, give the proponents some notice that it's going to happen, and come in. I detect a real resistance to this amendment on this bill at this time. I think it's a legitimate issue, and I support your concern on that issue, but I don't want to see this basic bill slowed down by a caboose that might have a brake step. I'm using these analogies, and basically I'm saying it's coming too late in this process without enough notice to the proponents to work on it. And I'm getting enough body language signals here that I think we should move the bill without it. But we should look for another bill that we could play with it, have some time. Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, this is a real important issue. And if maybe with the chair's concurrence, if before we send this train down the track, maybe if we took 24 hours or to see if there's another train, or whether we need to do some.
Here's what I'm going
to
do. I'll reset this for Tuesday, for work session. If by Tuesday, Mr. Carmichael, you've been able to work with enough members of this committee and the proponents of the bill and other concerned folks so that we come in, everyone that's here hears this, we're going to have a work session. People come in and say, here is the Morissette-Carmichael amendment that's agreeable. We've worked out the details. Great. Well, let's you attach it, and we'll move it. If not, the bill will be sent out of the station without the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I appreciate that. I presently would oppose this as it's written for several reasons, which I won't take the time to go into at this point. There is another bill that will be at the Education Committee that will have a relating clause that's relating to juveniles that will be providing for, it will have a requirement if any parents or children or teachers appear on a hit list in the school, apart from bringing a gun to school, requirement for notification. So the related clause would be to juveniles.
Is that a better vehicle?
Mr. Chairman, I'd point out very briefly to the chairman and to the chairman of the Education Committee that one of the statutes dealt with in the proposed amendments, this committee has already dealt with in House Bill 2599, which is the runaway bill, and you may want to make sure there's no conflict.
Well, we'll say Tuesday, and if I'm told you're on the verge and you need another couple of days, we'll do that too. But I don't like holding up bills too long at this part of the session, either Senate or House. We'll have plenty more to do, so we'll give you that time to work on it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This concludes the public hearing on Senate Bill 78. And are there folks here on the one other bill? It sounds like it's a quickie, so we'll go into work session on Senate Bill 341. Is that the next one up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I can explain this, I think, real quick.
I show 341 on the agenda. Is it something else? Yeah. I meant public hearing. Sorry. Karen Brazeau, Oregon Youth Authority, is that who you are?
That's who I am. There are no cabooses on this bill.
Good bill, do pass.
Handing out testimony, you probably don't have time to read it. Good bill.
I'm getting thumbs up from the audience. I have no one here in opposition and the folks that are here in support. Any committee members have any concerns? All right.
I do have one quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with whether or not you contract on your own as the youth authority for psychological evaluations, or do you do those in conjunction with the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, sometimes both. For the youth offenders that come into our custody through juvenile court, either the county juvenile department may have recently conducted a psychological, we will rely on that. If a young person comes to us through Department of Corrections, if they've recently conducted a psychological, we will rely on that. If there has not been one, we will do it ourselves.
Okay. Further questions?
I move Senate Bill 344.
We'll move into work session. Representative Sinceri.
I move Senate Bill 344 to the
341
to the floor was due passed.
Attention all passengers now leaving the station. Senate Bill 341. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, Senate Bill 341 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier. Representative Bowman will be the carrier. This concludes the work session on Senate Bill 341. We are in recess as to House Bill 2535 and Senate Bill 700, possibly until 1230. Thank you.